And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. Science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Alex Butwinski, who's filling in for Lynn Ware Peak, who is, as we say, off on assignment. But we have a fun show for you this morning. Our first guest, Alex Wright, author of Cataloging the World, Paul Otlet and the Birth of the Information Age. 40 years ago before the first personal computer and 50 years before the first browser, Otlet envisioned a network of electric telescopes that would allow people everywhere to search through books, newspapers, photographs, and recordings, all linked together in what he termed, in 1934, way back, a Rousseau Mondial, essentially a worldwide web. I look forward to our conversation with Alex about this interesting librarian and the birth of the information age.
Good morning, John. I'm Alex Butwinski. Our second guest this morning is Michael Blassland. He's co-author of the Norm Chronicles Stories and Numbers About Danger and Death, using statistics and a unit of measurement known as micromort, and you can't wait to hear about that. The Norm Chronicles covers everything from death by asteroid to the dangers of vaccinations, running a marathon, or even having that extra glass of wine. This is really a fun book, mixing stats and some fun stories to make it really fun for those who are not into just numbers.
Well, these two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern Pub Grub. Open daily at 5 p.m. Our website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Alex Butwinski, who's filling in for Lynn Ware Peak, who's off today. Our first guest, Alex Wright, author of Cataloging the World, Paul Otlet and the Birth of the Information Age. The dream of capturing and organizing knowledge is as old as history, from the archives of ancient Sumeria and the Library of Alexandria to the Library of Congress and Wikipedia. Humanity has wrestled with the problem of harnessing its intellectual output. And in Cataloging the World, Alex Wright introduces us to Paul Otlet, a librarian by training who worked at expanding the potential of the catalog card and from there, the information of the world. Alex, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, we both loved your book. And Paul Otlet was quiet. He was a shy librarian. He preferred books to people. Yet he believed so strongly in his vision to collect, organize, and catalog knowledge for the world that he would even plead his case to President Roosevelt and Hitler to save this knowledge from destruction by the Nazis. Tell us about this complicated, prophetic man.
Well, yeah, I mean, Otlet, he's an interesting guy. He, as you say, he started his career as a librarian. He, you know, going back to when he was a kid, he was really just obsessed with books. He was, you know, a real kind of, you know, classic bookworm. Very introverted. You know, grew up without a lot of friends. Spent a lot of time in the library. You know, just reading everything he could get his hands on. When he was a teenager, he started actually building his own little private museum, and he started building these systems for like collecting information. So he created eventually his own cataloging scheme that, even when he was a teenager, you know, sort of laid the foundations for what would become his life's work. So in the years that followed, he, you know, graduated from college. He, for a brief period, worked as a lawyer and decided that wasn't really for him, and eventually he sort of returned to his first love of books and began work on a project that would really consume him for the next 50 years, which was trying to create a catalog of all of the world's published information. And this was in the 1890s when this project first started. He began working with a partner, a guy named Henri Lafontaine, who he had met when he was working as a lawyer, who went on to become a very influential guy in his own right. LaFontaine went on to become a senator in Belgium and eventually actually won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work to promote world peace. And he, together, they were able to win the support of the Belgian government to help fund this project, which over the course of many years evolved into this massive compilation of eventually, they had more than 15 million entries in their catalog that they created, using what was the state-of-the-art information technology at the time, which was index cards. And they started, initially with this idea that they would try to catalog all the books in the world, and then over time, they began to expand their efforts to think about other types of media. For example, newspapers. They started an archive of the world's newspapers. They started cataloging scholarly journal articles, eventually photographs. Eventually, they expanded it to include moving pictures and audio recordings. And as time went on, that the vision just became progressively bigger. And at the same time, they started to see new technologies emerging, things like the telephones, and eventually radio and television and microfilm. And eventually, he started to sketch out this idea of a vision for how all of these things could come together in a network. And moving really beyond the physical world of books and index cards and towards something really that starts to look a lot like today's internet. You imagine that eventually you might have this electronic network that would circle the globe where anybody could pull up information on a screen from a remote location and sort of connect all those documents together through a series of links that would eventually make all the world's information available to anyone from their living room. So considering he proposed all of this, in the 1930s, before there were computers or networking as as we think about it. Fairly remarkable foresight that he had to really see all this coming 50 years before it really happened.
Absolutely, and certainly in the old days, way before Paul, if you wanted to learn about a dog, there was a way of indexing and going to a library and looking up dogs. But he also introduced symbolic links with multiple topics so that you could look up mathematics, chemistry, and dogs at the same time. And he had some very some of these cataloging schemes were mechanical, weren't they?
That's right. Yeah, it was a very sophisticated set of ideas that he had. I mean, it was not just a question of collecting a bunch of index cards with titles of books on them. He really thought pretty deeply about how could you index the contents of those books and make it available in a new way. Basically, he felt that the more he looked at this problem, the more he felt that books were becoming a kind of out-of-date technology, that they, as more and more information was being produced, he felt like they just weren't really up to the task of trying to, let people develop a big-picture understanding of all the knowledge that was being produced. And he felt like, if he could develop a scheme that would let you sort of dig into inside books and extract the information that's contained inside and then kind of cross-link that to a piece of information in another book, over time you could create sort of new forms of knowledge that would be much more efficient and much more fluid that could sort of evolve as human knowledge evolved. So he developed a scheme. It's called the Universal Decimal Classification that had all these very complex ways of creating connections between topics and between documents that eventually he thought would lend itself to a more automated kind of system.
And with all that, he managed to come up with I think you said 15 million. Entries. That's an awful lot of index cards.
It was a lot of work, but he didn't do it all alone. He had, he had a bunch of people working with him. They hired kind of a staff of catalogers and professional indexers. And one of the interesting things, even though in some ways he really anticipated something very much like, today's World Wide Web, in a way there were also some sort of important differences. One was he felt like it was very that the librarians had a very important role in the process. That they were really the ones who were qualified to really look at a document and describe it in detail and index it, and he felt like that sort of human element was an important part of the process. That there was a level of sort of quality control and organization around this whole thing, so that things wouldn't be lost or miscategorized. So in that sense, it's quite different from what the web is today, which is really much more of an open, kind of free for all kind of system, for better or worse.
Well, he was something of an idealist, I got the sense from your book, and it just struck me that he was very similar to, and this is probably a leap in some ways, to some of the visionaries that came before. For example, Leonardo's pictures of helicopters. And, you know, how did people come to find out about Paul Otlet?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He's not very well known today, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is he's Belgian, and almost all of his work was written in French. Most of it has not been translated. But also, you know, keep in mind he was working in Belgium in the first half of the 20th century. We all know what happened in Belgium in 1940. The Nazis came and disrupted everything, including Otlet's work. They actually came and questioned him. They were very interested in some of his. He had a lot of, over the years, he developed a lot of foreign contacts, and he was also a very active pacifist himself, and was actually involved at one point in the formation of the League of Nations. So he had political connections as well. So they were very interested in talking to him, and they came and interviewed him, and then they also looked at this huge collection that he developed, which was, you know, more at that point, more than just the big library catalog. He'd also created this vast kind of museum of all these different cultural objects that he collected over the years. And he was really trying to, you know, he was really kind of pleading with the Germans to preserve this. He felt like this is a resource for all of humanity. And even though he was certainly no fan of the Nazis, he felt like if they were going to be the new sheriff in town, he wanted to try to work with them to try to at least preserve his work. But they weren't having it. They sadly basically cleared out the entire contents of his office space. It was called the Palais Mondial, and they discarded and destroyed a huge amount of material that he developed, that he collected over the years, to make room for an exhibit of Third Reich art. And he died. He then died a few years later, just as the war was ending in 1944, and was subsequently just kind of forgotten. I mean, he was really, you know, if you think about it, at that time, the Belgians really had other things on their mind, like rebuilding their country, and his reputation just kind of faded. Although, you know, there were certainly, I think, in the library world, he's still known as, you know, an important figure who,
of course,
developed this interesting cataloging scheme. But that's, you know, a fairly, certainly, you know, to a broader public audience, he's certainly not a well-known person. And it was really not until the internet became a reality that people realized that he had written all this stuff that predicted this happening. It was not, you know, in 1945, it wasn't at all obvious, you know, what a visionary he was. And it was really only in hindsight that I think he's become historically important that we can see, oh, this guy was really, really onto something.
We are speaking with Alex Wright, who has written a fascinating book, Cataloging the World, Paul Otlet and the Birth of the Information Age. Not only in this book do you have sort of a biography of Paul and his many accomplishments, but there's some other things in here that I didn't know. You know, in 1844, the telegraph was invented by Samuel Morse. And my recollection is basically tied to Western movies. But when I think about, you know, some Western, there's a sheriff in a small town, and he telegraphs the marshal and says, hey, listen, I need some reinforcements. And, you know, it's just simply passing a couple messages back and forth, like I'll be on the stage tomorrow or something like that. But in reading your book, it's fascinating. The early telegraph pioneers saw this new invention as far more than just speeding up the transmission of text. And Samuel Morse says, if the presence of electricity can be made visible, I see no reason why intelligence might not be simultaneously transmitted by electricity to any distance. And it was very interesting that both Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Edison worked on telegraph-based devices that would enable photographs, pictures, all sorts of information to be sort of encoded in a sort of binary fashion of dots from one machine and reassembled on the other, kind of a, you know, sort of a precursor to the fax machine.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it was really, the telegraph was, you know, a pretty incredible breakthrough at the time. And, there's actually a great book by a guy named Tom Standage, who's a reporter for The Economist, wrote a book called The Victorian Internet, and makes the argument that, you know, the effect that the telegraph had in the 19th century is not far off from the effect that the internet has had today. I mean, it's, you know, it really revolutionized communication. It made it possible to transmit information in sort of real time around the world. It enabled newspapers to report on, you know, what happened in Paris, you know, the day before. This was unprecedented, and you're right. Some of the people who were working with that technology early on really saw the potential of it for more than just kind of transmitting text messages, but eventually it could become a platform for, as you say, for transmitting images or other things. So people were thinking about this for, you know, quite a while. You know, even before Otley, you know, Walt Whitman and Leaves of Grass, writes this sort of ode to the telegraph and what a wonderful kind of invention it is for, you know, dissolving the boundaries between countries and between people. Over the course of the 19th century, there were other people who had, you know, sort of interesting visions of like how of a sort of new networked world. There was a French novelist named Robida who had some interesting ideas along these lines about a new kind of internet-like environment. And even Mark Twain wrote a short story called From the London Times of 1904, where he proposed an idea called the telectroscope that was kind of like a video phone that would allow anybody to see what anybody else was doing anywhere in the world. So these kind of ideas were sort of in the air, you know, during this period. I mean, I think we tend to think of ourselves as living in this period of, you know, rapid technological change, but really the late 19th century was a pretty incredible time in terms of just the pace of invention, and, you know, with the combination of industrialization and telecommunications and people moving to cities, mass literacy. I mean, there was just a lot of people were really pretty excited about the possibilities of, you know, of these new tools for changing the way we communicate, and I think they shared a lot of the same,
of course,
excitement that we see today around the internet.
And on Cool Science Radio, we find it remarkable all the time when a new technology is introduced and how quickly different applications and collaboration between different groups takes place in pushing the technology forward in ways that no one anticipated. And I'm reminded by a quote that I wrote down a long time ago, so I'm going to actually read this. But it's Arthur C. Clarke, who, of course, was the great writer, and also he's a knight, Sir Arthur C. Clarke. And he once said, "If we have learned one thing from the history of invention and discovery, it's that in the long run, and often in the short one, the most daring prophecies seem laughingly conservative." And that's absolutely true, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good line. It seems that way. I mean, I think Otley's prophecy, for as farsighted as he was, you know, I'm not sure even he would have envisioned really quite the dramatic effect that the internet would have on, you know, the world economy and the cultural landscape. Even though he did, you know, the vision that he proposed was far beyond, you know, what anyone else was thinking about at the time. It probably would have surprised even him. So.
Right.
And another thing I found interesting was his collaboration with Le Corbusier, who I think may shock some people in Park City about one of his outrageous ideas, which we've had a visceral reaction to, which is taller buildings in part of our town, where Le Corbusier decided or thought about demolishing central Paris and putting in 60-story buildings.
I thought that's right.
It's kind of a like, holy cow.
Maybe not the best idea.
So they had a collaboration and an interesting vision. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So Otley worked with Le Corbusier on this proposal to develop a new headquarters for the League of Nations. So as I mentioned, Otley had been involved in the formation of the League of Nations. He was an early proponent of the idea of a sort of federation of countries to help prevent future wars. And he had earlier on worked with another pretty interesting character, a guy named Hendrik Andersen, who was actually an American sculptor living in Rome. And they kind of hatched this idea for what they called a world city. And the idea is it would be basically like a headquarters for something like the League of Nations, like a city where, you know, the world's governments could come together on kind of neutral ground and collaborate. It would also be a place where you could where the Olympics could be hosted and others. So there'd be an international university, and of course, Otley saw his great library project, which by this time he'd come to call the Mundaneum, as being kind of central to this world city as well. So eventually Le Corbusier got involved and started, they collaborated on this plan for this new headquarters space for the that was going to be a center for the League of Nations and for Otley's Mundaneum, which they saw as kind of joined at the hip. And they worked together and proposed that and actually staged an exhibit of it together, which, you know, did attract some interest. Unfortunately, it never quite came to fruition, and the League of Nations, as we all know, once World War II came along, the League of Nations actually proved quite ineffective. But interestingly, when the sort of successor organization, the United Nations, was launched after the war, Le Corbusier gave a speech talking about the vision of it, and he actually invoked Paul Ouellet as kind of an inspiring figure in thinking about what the United Nations could be as well. So his legacy did kind of reverberate a little bit further, you know, in this whole notion of like a utopian world government, which, you know, which he and Le Corbusier had sort of worked on together for several years.
Well, the other thing I was struck by was the fact that he was somewhat of an idealist who probably would have frowned on what actually happened with the internet. And I was wondering, you know, the commercialism of it. And I was wondering, you know, he would have been perhaps less than thrilled by the way it went. But wouldn't he, as a somewhat of an idealist, realize the pros and the cons of commercialism becoming part of what allowed science to move forward?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, I mean, I think one of the really stark contrasts, you know, with that you see between what Ouellet proposed and the internet as it played out is that, you know, Ouellet really envisioned almost no commercial activity on this, you know, on the system that he devised. He really saw it primarily as a tool for scholarship and fostering collaboration between governments, and ultimately as a vehicle for promoting understanding and scholarly progress. He really did not, like, commerce just didn't enter into the way he was thinking about it so much, although he did actually sort of envision a small role for bookstore, interestingly. So it just wasn't the way he was thinking about it, and he was very much, you know, he was a product of his age. I mean, it was an era of institutions, and, you know, he was very taken with the possibility of integrating international institutions like scholarly associations and universities. I mean, he was very, you know, real idealist, very probably, you know, shared a belief in his age in the sort of positive potential of institutions to promote understanding and intellectual progress. You know, he didn't write that much about the private sector. It's not that he was necessarily opposed to it, but he really saw this as primarily a sort of nonprofit initiative. And, you know, it's hard to say exactly what he would have thought of the internet, but I think he probably would have been a little surprised at how it's been really largely driven by commercial interests, certainly in the last few years. Although it's interesting to note that when the internet was first launched, it was really envisioned as something more along the lines of what Ouellet had in mind. He proposed it was originally purely a vehicle for promoting cooperation between universities and government scientific researchers. And it was really only in 1993 when the National Science Foundation opened it up to commercial activity that it sort of changed the whole course of, you know, of what the internet would be.
And who knows where it's going to go?
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know, we have no idea. You know, you mentioned in your book, Alex, that that you believe that Paul Ouellet is still, that he still matters, that he's still relevant. You know, why do you say that?
Well, I think what he offers us is a kind of platonic ideal. Like, he really envisioned a network that was much more, I would say, purposeful and sort of idealistic, and much less driven by sort of profit motives and kind of personal, you know, vanity, which is a lot of what drives a lot of the activity you see on the internet these days. He really thought of it in much more, much more in terms of improving, you know, the lot of humanity and instituting positive social change and promoting intellectual understanding. You know, for him, he really came in from a very idealistic place. And I think there's something inspiring about that, even if the mechanics of what he proposed, you know, seem outdated and probably kind of anachronistic today. I think the spirit behind it is, you know, something that's worth considering. I mean, he really came at this from a very altruistic, very noble kind of place, and I think that's something that sometimes feels missing in the sort of commercial caterwaul that we see on the internet today.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you one final question. That's about the printing press. You know, obviously we all know that the printing press was extraordinarily important You had a little bit in there about the impact that it had to the world. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, sure. I mean, the printing press is certainly a well-studied topic in the history of of technology, and it, no doubt that its impact has been lasting and transformative for society at large. I think what sometimes people tend to overlook is that there was actually kind of a second printing revolution that happened. You know, there was, everyone knows about, you know, Johannes Gutenberg, 15th century, introduced the printing press, and Martin Luther came along and famously, used the printing press to distribute his 99 theses and created a lot of disruption to the sort of standing order of the day with the Roman Catholic Church. But it was really in the 19th century that you saw this rapid acceleration of printing that happened largely as a result of industrialization and the growth of public education and mass literacy. So those two things combined, I think, really created laid the foundations for our modern information age in a way that, the printing press itself, while it was important, did not immediately trigger this wave of mass literacy. It was for the first, 400-odd years of the printing press, it was still a very kind of manual operation of setting type by hand and, creating pages one at a time using these kind of corkscrew presses. But it was really industrialization that really triggered the massive acceleration whose effects I think we're still feeling today.
Right. Well, Alex, we've really enjoyed this conversation. We could, we could talk to you all morning. I wanted to close with a quote in your book from John Fox, English historian, talking about the printing press. Hereby tongues are known, knowledge grows, judgment increases, books are dispersed, the scripture is seen, the doctors are read, histories open, times compared, truth discerned, falsehood detected, and all through the benefit of printing. And I got a kick out of it. I mean, I've heard about how great the printing press is. Of course, we all know it's great. But to hear a quote from an historian from back in the day, it was good. But anyway, Alex, who is the Alex Wright author of Cataloging the World, Paul Otlet, and The Birth of the Information Age, we want to thank you very much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Next up, Michael Blastland, co-author of The Norm Chronicles, stories and numbers about danger and death. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
We were just talking with Alex Wright, author of Cataloging the World with Paul Otlet and The Birth of the Information Age. Our next guest is Michael Blastland, co-author of The Norm Chronicles, stories and numbers about danger and death. What is safer, ecstasy or a hospital stay? Perhaps surprisingly, the answer is ecstasy, and while the drug isn't safe, we're not recommending that, isn't safer than everything, it is safer than a scuba dive, a skydive, and horseback riding. But it's not safer than a lifetime's risk from an asteroid. Let's dive into the Norm Chronicles, stories and numbers about danger and death, to see what else we can learn. Michael, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So we'd like again to thank Alex Wright and for speaking with us today. And we will...
No, go ahead.
Continue to go?
No, go ahead and ask him your question.
Oh, so I noticed that you introduced us to three very interesting characters, Norm, Prudence, and the Kelvin brothers. which I thought was an intriguing way to get people to not just focus on the dry numbers part of the book, but how some of the examples I did in the intro affect people. So, you know, what do we learn from those folks?
Well, I think what we're trying to encourage people to do is to think about their own state of mind about risk, what kind of character they have, what kind of attitudes they bring to anything that find threatening or anything even they find exciting, and recognize that those attitudes and beliefs are going to make a big difference to the way that they see the numbers. This is our contention that risk, although we talk about risk as a set of probabilities, you know, your chance of dying if you do X, Y, or Z, as you did in your introduction there, and that's a perfectly sensible thing to do, it's just a long way short of the way that people actually respond to risky situations. You know, there's so much else going on in our psychologies to do with our history, our own character, our own sense of adventure, who we care about, whether we think the benefits are better than the risks and so on, and a whole bundle of things going on in there. But what we're really trying to do is say, imagine the whole person responding to risk. This is what we have to do. Great deal of pressure, I think, to try and reduce it to numbers. And the numbers matter, believe me. I mean, you quoted those numbers there. We spend a lot of time looking up numbers. But the numbers are not the whole story. That's simply the point of introducing these characters. We do tell stories about data, about numbers, about life, and about risk. And so we wanted to introduce some of that storytelling element that forms part of all our judgments into the way that we discuss the whole process of evaluating risk.
Well, interestingly, at least for me, it seemed like the beginning of each paragraph, each chapter, had what I somehow just came back to thinking about a Monty Python skit. I was wondering whether, you know, just the way the interaction between the two characters had their conversations that were cut off, you know, when Norm's parents met each other, for example. What gave you that idea? I mean, I think it's very clever.
Honored to be compared with Monty Python and their reunion in London this week, by the way. No, I can't claim to to be writing Python quality script there, but we wanted to make it entertaining. We did feel that we wanted to enjoy this book, because you say to yourself, we want to do something where we're looking at a whole bunch of risks of things that might kill you. This could be a pretty somber undertaking. You know, and it's not in fact true to the way that we feel about life ourselves. I mean, we both feel that life is there to be lived and risks to some extent to be taken. So we wanted to, some of that feeling of, you know, joie de vivre, the excitement, the thrill, as well as the sense of forbidding and danger. And we chose to try and inject some of that into the fiction with as much humor as we could muster, and as much character in those three figures you mentioned earlier on.
So to get everybody on a level playing field, you introduced the micromort, which is a way of measuring. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Okay. One of the big problems, I think, when we're talking about risk is that there are lots of different ways of doing it. And, you know, you can have chances of a million of this or in 100,000 of that, or how many people in the population, or simply how many people died doing a certain activity. And you've got to try and, if you want to know whether something really is riskier than something else, you need a common way, a consistent way of comparing all these things. So what we did, we used a measurement which was actually devised by Professor Ron Howard in Stanford in the 1970s, called a micromort. And one micromort is equal to a 1 in a million chance of death. And that just happens to be slightly less than the chance that the average American on an average day will meet a sudden violent end from what statisticians call an external cause. So we're not talking about heart disease here or cancer. We're talking about, you know, falling under a bus or something like that, or, you know, the axe murderer pops up around the corner, that kind of thing. That happens to be not very far off one micromort each day, a 1 in a million chance that on an average day, we're not talking about you going base jumping or on the front line in Afghanistan. We're not talking about that kind of thing. We're just talking about an ordinary average day for an American about one micromort, about one in a million chance of sudden death, violent death from an external cause. And once you've got that in place, you can compare just about any event, any sudden event to that one micromort, and you can contrast everything that happens in life to the one micromort risk that you have each day, very approximately. And you can do it by age, you can do it by where you live, you can do it by the kind of things that you're doing. So, for example, I mean, one that I love, if you happen to be 10 years old in the United States, the chance that you will die before your next birthday is the lowest for any age just about ever. And it's about 100 micromorts for the whole year. So remember our one micromort comparison, that was one micromort a day. If you're 10, the total is only 100 micromorts for the whole year.
But if you're 24...
If you're 24, yeah, it begins to go up a little.
It does. Actually, that was the highest, wasn't it?
That's where we begin to meet the behavior of young men, for example, who tend to be a little bit more risk-taking. And you're absolutely right. It goes up quite sharply. It's some way above the average.
Well, we don't know any people like that. But, you know, it's interesting. They say the numbers don't lie, but of course numbers can be manipulated or just the way you look at them. So you have in your book here, for an example, there's an advertising campaign in the London Underground that proudly declares 99% of our young Londoners do not commit serious youth crime. That sounds pretty good.
Sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does. But then when you take it literally and you break it down, that means 1% of young Londoners commit serious crime, and there's about a million young Londoners, which implies that 10,000 young thugs are running around. So it's not so wonderful.
Yeah, this is a very curious thing. If you concentrate on the number of things that do happen, you get one perspective on risk. If you concentrate on the number that don't happen, you get another one. So I'll give you another example. Actually, this is based on some real research. So if you eat a sausage a day, an extra sausage a day, or an extra two or three rashers of bacon each day, very roughly it increases your chance of colorectal cancer by about 20%. Very roughly. So that you have to eat this stuff every day for the rest of your life, and it increases your risk by 20%. But what I'm doing there is that 20% is an increase over the number of people who generally get it anyway. So we're talking about 20% more. Forget the bacon for a minute. What normally happens is that about 5 people in 100 have colorectal cancer in a lifetime. So our 20% is an extra one person in that 100. If all 100 of them eat this extra bacon for the rest of their lives. So if you're still with me on the math here. But now let's look at it the other way around. So to begin with, 95 people out of 100 do not get colorectal cancer. Again, we're going to feed all 100 of them 3 rashers of bacon every day for the rest of their lives, and it now drops to 94. So we've talked about a 1% fall, very roughly a 1% fall in your chance of being okay, the chance of nothing happening, has fallen by 1%. But if we look at it the other way around, if we look at it in terms of the people who are affected, then it's a 20% increase in your chance of something going wrong. So I can flip it from something that looks like a really serious increase in your chance of something terrible happening. If I look at it in terms of nothing happening and how many people to whom nothing is going to happen, then it's a very small decrease in the chance of you not being fine. And we can do that with just about any kind of risk. And the statisticians talk about this as a framing effect. It depends entirely how you frame the evidence, and you can produce very different reactions you can imagine in people according to the way that you frame those risks.
Oh, yeah. And then we talk about media bias, and we talk about, you know, people trying to sell newspapers or trying to sell advertisement on TV. They're talking about all these people being killed by tornadoes, and there's so much more a higher incidence of risk for kids that have asthma.
Exactly. I mean, we're just talking about the way that you present the information. Before you even get to anybody's agenda about this, you know, whether they're trying to twist things in any way, this is simply about whether you take what's called a negative frame, you emphasize the bad events, or a positive frame, and you emphasize the chance of everything being all right. But you're absolutely right about the hurricanes and the asthma. You know, if you ask people which is more likely to get you, they're very worried about hurricanes. In fact, asthma is a much, much greater risk of fatality from asthma. So you say, well, why is it that people seem to fear this rare thing, and but not to be so concerned about this much more common thing? And the explanation psychologists offer for this is they talk about the salience. They talk about the way that things basically that might make good TV seem to us to be more common. So if it looks dramatic, we tend to think that it's more common. If it doesn't sound or look dramatic, we tend to think it's more rare. And this is a pretty puzzling response, but it's a very common human response. It's to assign more significance to the things which loom large in our imaginations than the things that are really statistically common out there.
Yeah, that's really very true. You know, Michael, it did my heart good to hear you say that, you know, bacon is not that bad for you, because I eat a lot of bacon.
Yeah, you and me both, yeah.
But you know, we've kind of left off Norm, Prue, and Kelvin. And, you know, you had an interesting anecdote about them in the subway and the bags, the three bags, and how they each interpreted in their own lives the statistics that would make them make choices or have them make choices.
Yeah. So what we did, we imagined our three fictional characters on the tube, and they each discover separately, they're traveling separately, they each discover an unattended bag. Now, your listeners may know that there was a very violent act of terrorism on the London transport system, and three bombs were left. Nearly 60 people were murdered by those acts of terrorism. So what do you do if you find an unattended bag? Well, the psychological responses are we made them as different as we possibly could, and one of the characters immediately assumes that this must be a bomb, that I need to get off this train as soon as possible. Another one is continually tries to tell himself that the probabilities of this being a bomb are tiny, because there are tens and tens of thousands of left items of luggage on London transport every year, and in most years none of them explodes. So he tries to reassure himself with the probabilities and says, it's okay, you'll be fine, but he can't quite quell the sense of disquiet. And our third character sees an unattended bag and opens it and helps himself to anything in there that he thinks is useful. And that, I think that, I hope that those are all plausible reactions.
Oh, totally. I think they are. And I think it's important to point out that you know, you've got these statistics that and math that you all have so thoroughly researched, but then it comes down to the human beings. You've got Prudence, who is extraordinarily conservative. She thinks when she hears footsteps, someone's about to murder her, and maybe that's the far end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum, you've got the Kelvin brothers, who are basically, hey, listen, not a problem. And then the guy in the middle, of course, is Norm, who represents the sort of normalcy. But you can group people, maybe not to the extreme so much, but it's people's interpretation of risk and people's interpretation of situations, isn't it?
I think that's exactly right, because every one of your listeners could answer the question themselves. How risky is an unattended bag on a subway or a bus? And we'll all have our own sense of the risk involved. And it may have a little bit to do with the numbers. For some people, they'll say, well, the probabilities are so low, this hardly ever happens. There are millions of passengers and millions of bags, and it's just not going to happen. And for others, I think their heart will be in their mouth. And who's right? Who's right about that? That's a difficult thing to say, because you know, your sense of danger depends on a great many things other than probabilities. You know, two people can climb on the same roller coaster. We call them roller coasters. Do you have the same term that, you know, they kind of...
We do, yeah. There?
Yeah, we do.
And one of them can feel that they're living, they're breathing their last breath, and the others can feel that that's just a scream, you know, loved it. And our sense of risk is in our skin as much as in our heads. It exists in what we value as well as what we fear. So here's another funny phenomenon. if you think you're going to get something really valuable from taking a risk, you think that the risk is objectively lower. Not that just you think, not that just your subjective perception is that it's lower. You think everybody must agree that this is a low risk. So if you're really happy at the idea of having a baby, you think the chance of postnatal depression, postpartum depression, is low. If you're more nervous about having a child, you think the risk of postpartum depression is higher. But it has almost no relationship to the actual risk of postpartum depression. Your feelings about that risk are very influenced by how much you expect to get from the experience. You know, and many mothers will say, how could I possibly experience depression when I'm so looking forward to having this child? And they think the risk must be tiny. But actually, the risk is significant. But what that tells us is that the sheer numbers don't adequately explain people's decisions and behavior, because the numbers on the downside, on the risk side, fail to take account of the numbers on the positive side. And those positive perceptions of what you're going to get from taking a risk matter every bit as much as the perceptions of what might go wrong.
You know, there's another interesting way in which to look at statistics, and that is it's the Poisson element of probability theory, and the fact that just because there's a chance of 1 in 100, or I think you used the example of potentially one event happening every day, that isn't quite as simple as that. In other words, you can't wake up in the morning and say, well, that guy already fell off the bridge, so the odds of me falling off the bridge are zero.
You
know, what's that about?
You're quite right. I mean, we use an average figure, and none of us is average. I mean, that's one of the other awkward problems for producing data about risk, that nobody precisely corresponds with all the characteristics necessary to make you at the average risk. You may be a little bit older. You may be a bit more sedentary. You may be richer or poorer. You may drive that little bit faster. Your other habits may be just that little bit different. You may be a bit taller. You know, your eyesight may be a little bit better. Or there are a million and one different factors that can affect your susceptibility to a risk. And the one that you mentioned there is really the play of chance. And it's absolutely right that chance doesn't arrive evenly. It arrives in lumps and bumps and clusters. So I'll tell you a little story. Again in London, we had a big panic because there were four stabbings in one day in London. People thought, how could you have four in one day? That's, you know, this looked like a terrible number. We don't see that kind of thing too much in London. And they thought, this must mean an epidemic of knife crime. But here's a little mental experiment you can do. Imagine last year's murders, and there were in London, there were about 170 of them. And imagine them all as grains of rice. And then imagine that you have the whole of the year's calendar spread out in front of you, 365 days, and you throw last year's rice grains, throw last year's murders over the calendar, 170 grains over 365 days. And ask yourself, could chance, just chance, nothing sinister going on, no sudden terrible trend, just chance, place four grains of rice on one square? And most people will say, not very likely, but yeah, that could happen. That could happen by chance. And they're right, actually. We'd expect it to happen about once every 3 years. And the distribution of murders in London precisely fits that expectation, that distribution. Absolutely precisely. We get about four murders in London on one day, about once every 3 years. So the huge panic that this represented some terrible new trend, because how could it be possible you get four events of this kind on one day? Well, actually, it's more than possible. It's likely that you will get that, simply given the existing numbers that we're already seeing. Because things, they cluster naturally. They cluster for unnatural reasons too, of course, but they also cluster naturally. Things come along in lumps and bumps, and they go up, and the numbers go up and down, and they do that just as a matter of course. That's the normal way of the world. You know, if you just look around us, and things do not happen with perfect regularity all the time. That's a slightly difficult thing to get our heads around the idea that four murders in one day could be,
of course,
not unusual. And of course, every one of those is a terrible event. I'm not trying to suggest that this is a, you know, something we should just kind of relax about. But in terms of understanding what it means, whether it means a new trend or something of that sort, nope, it doesn't have to mean anything of the kind.
Michael, we've really enjoyed this conversation. We could speak with you a long time. It's a great book. I wanted to ask you a final question.
Sure.
If you could take a shot at this quickly. In all of the research that you did, and there's a lot of, obviously you did a lot of work in putting this book together, was there anything that really surprised you?
Okay, the most startling single risk is that if you, having an all-body CT scan, and people sometimes do this, they sometimes have them for birthday presents, you know, just give yourself a check over, it exposes you to about as much ionizing radiation as being around about a mile and a half from the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. And you can look at that in two ways. You can say, well, either that means an all-body scan is a huge amount of radiation, or you can say, which is also true, or is probably more true, that radiation diminishes really quickly over distance. But it's still a pretty shocking one.
Yeah, that would be shocking.
Think that this thing, which is really valuable, healthcare, sure, can have the numbers can be similar to something which is so shocking and frightening and violent.
Yeah.
But the numbers are similar, which again just emphasizes the point that the psychology also makes a lot of difference.
That's true, I'd like to thank you, Michael, for coming on with us this morning. It was fascinating to read your book. I think one of the takeaways for me, or maybe a couple of them, is probably three. One is for listeners or readers not to be put off by the title. And I thought the closing was good, which is there's no substitute for judgment. And the final thing was the probability of death is 100%.
That's right.
Don't mean to scare everybody, but it's a real cliche.
Thanks very much. And I have to say this, take care.
Thanks again.
We will. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. All bye-bye.
Right. We'll be back after this message.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows.
Yeah,
ParkCityNursery.com.
Like
Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, and Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.
We also want to thank our two guests this morning, Alex Wright, author of Cataloging the World, Paul Otlet, and the Birth of the Information Age, and of course, Michael Blasland, who co-wrote the Norm Chronicles, Stories and Numbers About Danger and Death. The person he co-wrote it with was David Spiegelhalter. And let me see. Well, we'd be remiss if we did not thank Beth Fratkin, who's our producer extraordinaire, for setting all of this up. And it is currently 72 degrees outside the Sweet Alley Studios, going up to 88 today, 20% chance of showers this afternoon. But tomorrow and Saturday, it's going to be absolutely beautiful, going to be perfect. Alex Butwinski, I want to thank you for joining me this morning. Great job pinch hitting for Lynn Ware Peak.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, NPR News is up next. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Cool Science Radio, over and out.